The following Aloud podcast was recorded live in 2008 at the historic Central Library in the heart of downtown LA as part of the award-winning Aloud series presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Aloud podcasts are made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arent Fox and by individual contributions from listeners like you. For more information on Aloud, or to find out how you, too, can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please visit our website, www.aloudla.org. Andre Debuse III is the author of a collection of short fiction, The Cage Keeper and Other Stories, and the novels Blues Man and House of Sand and Fog. Before finding his calling as a writer, he worked for brief stints as a bounty hunter, private investigator, carpenter, bartender, actor, and teacher. He may have resisted the idea of being an author for many years because his father, Andre Debuse, who died in 1999, is very well recognized and continues to be so as one of America's best short fiction writers. He taught and did odd jobs as a carpenter while working on House of Sand and Fog, most of which he wrote in his car. An Academy Award-nominated motion picture and published in 17 languages, House of Sand and Fog was a fiction finalist for the National Book Award, the Los Angeles Times Book Prize, and was an Oprah Book Club selection and a number one New York Times bestseller. His new book, In the Garden of Last Days, begins on an early September night. Let's try that again. In Florida, a stripper brings her daughter to work. April's usual babysitter is in the hospital, so she decides it's best to have her three-year-old daughter close by, watching children's videos, drinking chocolate milk in the office while she works. Brett Anthony Johnston wrote of The Garden of Last Days in Esquire, "When the critics weigh in, there will be plenty of chatter about how Debuse so deeply inhabits even the most disturbing characters, and rightly so. But the book's most profound achievement is a far more difficult one, the omnipresence of hope in a hopeless place. The Garden of Last Days is riveting and disturbing, as beautiful as it is bleak, and if there are cowards among the cast of broken characters, I couldn't find them." In conversation with Andre Debuse tonight is David Ulin, book editor of the Los Angeles Times and the author of The Myth of Solid Ground, Earthquakes, Prediction, and the Fault Line Between Reason and Faith. He's also the editor of Another City, Writing from Los Angeles, and Writing Los Angeles, a literary anthology. He's written for many publications, including The Atlantic Monthly, The Nation, The New York Times Book Review, and National Public Radio's All Things Considered. David has visited almost every one of the United States. He is saving Oregon, apparently, for last. Please welcome Andre Debuse III and David Ulin.
Thank you, Louise. My uncle here. I have to say hi to my Uncle Nick. How you doing, Nick?
I haven't been to Montana either, but I have been to South Dakota. All right. Thanks for coming out and joining us on the night that the Democratic presidential nomination process finally ends. So we're gonna talk, like Louise said, for a while, and then after a while we'll open it up to questions from you guys. And we'll work a small reading into the mix here somewhere. I wanted to start by asking you, just sort of generally discussing the role of politics in fiction, because in its own way, I mean, this isn't a political novel, but it touches on. There's a political component to the novel. I'm curious about what kinds of challenges that brings up for you as a fiction writer.
Well, that's a good question. I've never been asked. I think the politics is like psychology in that both run the risk of reducing fiction, if that makes any sense. You know, talk about psychology for a minute. We all know that our psychology is important. I think psychology has been, and it's a very helpful social science, but I think it's been elevated a little too highly in our culture, and I think we count on it a little bit too much. I think just because I may have been, you know, I haven't been, but if I'd had the tragedy of having been abused as a child. I think we hear too often, I'm a survivor of abuse, and that's all I am. When that's certainly part of who we are, and that's a terrible thing to have happened to a child. But that's not it. It's not all someone is. And also with politics, I think the danger is it reduces, can reduce fiction if we're trying to make a political point. One of the things I love about writing is that it's wide and deep and mysterious, and that I think if we go deeply enough into the human imagination, we find things we never knew we would find. And so I purposely try not to make a political point or say something, but if it comes in, I'll sure as hell allow it.
Well, it's interesting because back there you were talking about how you, your fiction doesn't come out of your life experience. You know, you said you wrote one story that evolved sort of specifically from a life event, but that really when you sit down and write fiction, you're imagining other lives, other, you know, other parts of the country, other kinds of characters. This book being a perfect example, that the two main, or at least to me, the two main characters, one is a woman and one is... I don't know how much of the plot I want to give away,
right.
But one is essentially a terrorist.
Yeah.
And I'm curious about sort of thinking your way into those kinds of characters. And I mean, I think the same is true of House in the Sand and Fog, thinking your way into characters whose life experience geographically, culturally, socially is so different from your own.
Yeah. I think one of the things I really, really love about the novel is, not any novel I've written, but the novel as a form is how wide and deep it can really go. I mean, it really is my favorite art form because of what it can sometimes do. And in the hands of a great writer like Tolstoy or someone like that, it can really do. But you know, it's interesting, you talked about, okay, let me just follow up with that. And to me, it's like cooking a tomato sauce. This is a bad analogy, but I love to cook. And I'm the cook in my family, and I was making a tomato sauce one day, and I thought, you know, I like basil. I'm going to put a little licorice in my tomato sauce, and fennel. So I put the fennel in, then I put in the basil, and that worked. And I put a little honey in, and that combination was really delicious, this honey, basil, fennel. And that's kind of the one I make all the time. But one day, I said, enough of this fennel. I put all that in, and then I threw in rosemary and killed the sauce. And I realized, wow, rosemary doesn't go with fennel at all. And one of the things I love about the novel is, so I do really enjoy bringing in disparate elements from far away to see if they'll take. You know, the fennel and the basil and the honey took, but the rosemary didn't. And there were characters in the first draft of this novel that were extricated with my editor's horrifying help because they didn't take as well.
So what's the drafting process? Do you write a full draft all the way through and then go back and
no
mess around?
I go really slowly. I'm very slow, and I go one moment at a time. You know, I teach writing. One of the things I hear myself saying is that people can do whatever they want. They can write, you know, whatever. There's no one way to do any of this. But for me, I feel enough confidence to continue creatively if I believe that what happened. If she's sitting with him and she says, I just don't love you anymore, and I keep believing that she believes that and said it, then I'll write the next scene, which might be his reaction. But if I don't believe it, I have to rewrite before I continue. It's as if this novel is a deck of cards and each floor has to be solid. I wrote a scene a while ago is probably 9 years ago, but it was a scene where a man and woman, he comes home from a night out with the boys and they make love. And I thought it was a pretty good sex scene. I mean, I thought it was written, it wasn't too explicit, and I thought I liked it, but I never bought it. You know, Hemingway said that every writer needs a built-in shock-proof shit detector. Pardon my French, but that's what the Nobel Prize winner said, and it kept going off whenever I read the sex scene. And then I went back, and then I realized, and I got back into it, and, you know, he'd been playing poker and drinking whiskey and smoking cigars all night. He hadn't shaved in 3 days, and he comes in, and he gives her a kiss, and I think, yeah, she's going to want to kiss him, too. But once I got deeper into it, it was clear, there's no way she's going to have sex with him.
Right.
He's sleeping
right
on the couch. So if I can, if I believe the moment, I keep writing.
Right.
And of course, the rewriting really has to do with sentences and prose rhythm and trying to make it... more aesthetically pleasing.
Now, I want to go back. Just to talk about the genesis of this book, this was inspired by actual events in some sense, right? By the notion of what some of the 9/11 hijackers had done in the last few days prior to the...
Well, yes and no. I mean, strangely, the truth is, this is all around 9/11, but I never really thought about 9/11 while writing it. And what started it was an image that in my head, and this happens a lot for me, and I think it happens a lot for a lot of writers. I just had this image of cash on a bedroom bureau. I just kept seeing a good wad of cash, and I didn't know whose it was and where it came from. And I wrote myself into that image, and it became clear that they were tips. Mm-hmm. Then it became clear they were strippers' tips, and then I realized, oh, I know where I got this. When we, you know, after that terrible day in 01 and the smoke had cleared, we were reading about how some of these guys were seen in strip clubs, which I thought was just so dumbfounding. But I was more interested in what would it be like to be a woman who's danced naked for one of these men and then to have given herself in some way to him, and then after the terrible thing has happened, to have some of his blood money in your possession. And really, I just set out to write a short story. I thought it would be maybe, you know, 10 pages. And
right.
You know, cover her life in 24 hours. And it just kept going and going.
That's the Thomas Mann syndrome, right? The Magic Mountain was originally supposed to be a novella the length of Death in Venice. Supposed to be 75 pages. And I guess 723 pages later, he got to the end.
See, what do writers know?
Exactly. It was interesting. You said you weren't really thinking about 9/11 because I mean, 9/11 as you would have to expect, I guess, in the last 3-4 years, has really crept into the American novel as a kind of counterpoint or subtext. Even, you know, in some cases really overtly, and in some cases pretty subtly. And I'm wondering about once you knew that you were writing about this. Comes sort of I'm oblique or not quite obliquely trying to circle back to the politics question. Once you knew what you were writing about, did that ever give you pause at some point?
Yeah. I didn't even want to continue. As long as I was writing from the point of view of this woman who brings her child to work and is dancing, and I'm not going north where they went. I was completely into it, but about 2 years into it, maybe 3 years into it, because it took 5 years, I felt pulled by the Saudi Arabian character who we only get to know through her point of view in one of these private champagne rooms he pays $250 for an hour for. We only get to know him through dialogue, talking to her while we're in her point of view. And as I got deeply into the novel, I could feel him. It's a strange thing. I know I'm not the only writer in the room, but that strange intuitive feeling that this character wants to be part of the story. And I resisted him. I didn't want to write from his point of view, and I didn't want to go there. And I think for two reasons. One, I had a Middle Eastern character in my last novel, House of Sand and Fog, even though they're very different. I mean, that character was a secular Shiite Muslim from Iran, a military man. This guy was a young extremist Sunni Muslim from Saudi Arabia. So there's no really repetition. But also, here's why I really didn't want to do it. So I live north of Boston, right? And I know we all have stories of that day. Well, there are about 60 people on those planes from our neck of the woods north of Boston. And we knew a lot of, I didn't know any of them personally. My wife knew one of her best friends in high school lost both her parents on the first plane. There were a lot of stories like that. And I go to UMass Lowell every day or 3 days a week, and I have to drive down along the Merrimack River, and I pass through Amesbury, past the house of a woman who was pregnant with their second child when her 38-year-old salesman husband got on the plane that I am writing about from the point of view of one of the men who helped kill him. And so that was the great reticence to even get involved. I've never had this as a writer. I've never had this creative experience where I felt as if I began to imagine what it might be like to meet Nikos Kazantzakis writing The Last Temptations of Christ, where you're kind of treading on sacred ground. You know, be careful what you're doing here. So that was my reticence. It wasn't a political feeling, but it was one more of a, and I still feel it to this day. There's a feeling of wanting to honor real people who lost real loved ones, but also to be honest and try to capture this guy as truly as I can without judgment.
Right. Well, this is interesting. This opens up a couple of interesting questions. The first is, I think what you're getting at, which really interests me, is the kind of the moral complexity and in some ways the moral complicity of the writer, because in order to do justice to the character, you have to do justice to the character in the world of the book. But then, as you say, the book exists in this bigger world and a bigger world that you're part of, and particularly the way you're part of it in a community that did lose a lot of people on those planes, that's fascinating to wrestle with. I mean, and you say, so you still wrestle even now that the book is done. The question is, if over the 5 years that you wrote, so you started writing the book in 2003.
Yep.
So that was pretty close on the heels of the event.
Right.
Did that end up, did your sense of it end up lessening or changing with distance? Because, you know, because in terms of the way the culture feels, it feels significantly different now than it did in 2002. So I'm curious for you, working on this book over a long period of time, during a period of time when the culture itself is changing in the way it views and reacts to this significant event, what was the effect of that on the way the on your process?
All right, I have a friend who, terrible story, but her father shot her mother to death and then killed himself. And he was actually wanting to go out in a blaze of glory. He called the police and he wanted to shoot out. And there's some evidence he was maybe going to kill all five children too. And so being around her, it's hard to talk about parents and grandparents and things like that because of her past. I'm happy to tell you that she's one of the most spiritually evolved and healthy. Let me say, that's not a good description. This is a beautiful 48-year-old woman who just exudes light and goodness and love for people. I don't know how she's done it. I bring her up because, but I can talk to her about that kind of crime now directly because there's been a lot of time. And I think time does sort of soften the blow. It was, as we all know, we've all lost people. We all know that the first year of bereavement, you're sort of temporarily insane. And I think the culture, our culture has been temporarily insane with this trauma and this mass murder of 3,000 people. But I think after 6.5, 7 years, maybe we're able to look at it a little bit. I have to say, too, though, that I didn't think about any of this while I was writing it. And I'll tell you why. I always think of the reader. I think of an ideal reader who's smart and sensitive and who's patient, who'll give me 100 pages before they, you know, kick the book out, the house, you know, get out of here.
That's an optimistic reader, right? You know?
Oh, yeah. Well, all right, 50. And but I don't think about a readership. And so because I think otherwise, then you start to second guess what readers want and what readers need. And I think that's death to creativity. I think that if there's any one single enemy to creativity, I don't think it's just writing. I think it's a lot of things in life. It's probably self-consciousness. I think if we're watching ourselves do something, we're no longer in the moment and we lose it. So I've tried very hard not to think about any of this, but I have to say I've been really nervous since the book came out. I'm sorry.
Well, just to stay on to keep you nervous. So Bassam, is the name of this Saudi character, and I think one of the things that's interesting to me is the way that nervousness or reservations or whatever, you humanize him, which you have to. You're writing about a character. He needs to be a three-dimensional human being in the world, as all of these guys were. They were all three-dimensional. And there's this one moment that sticks out for me where his father says to him, when he's talking to his father about jihad and what jihad is, he's discovered this concept, and his father, who's a devout man in his own way, says to him, stops and says, now listen, you were never a very bright boy, so pay attention. And it's one of these moments where it's absolutely true in some way because you can see how people get led, but it's also one of those heart-stopping moments where as a kid or a parent yourself, you know, you've sort of been in these moments where things get said, and it has that... I mean, you can't help but feel sympathy for this guy having had that said to him in this, you know, quiet, you're not very bright, so pay attention.
Yeah.
And there are these moments that really humanize this character. So I wanted to ask you a bit about the process of humanizing, not as a political statement, but as an aesthetic statement, the work of humanizing this character, of creating a three-dimensional character. And in some ways, going back to what you were saying, the difficulty of that, because it sounds like as a writer, you resisted that idea of bringing him that fully into the work.
Yeah. Thank you. That did become my goal. My goal was, how do I just make this guy real, no matter how I feel about him? I try to live by this great Hemingway line. You know, he said, the job of the writer is not to judge, but to seek to understand. Now, there are all kinds of writers who would disagree with that. A satirist wouldn't agree with that. But certainly, the kind of fiction I try to write, which is this character-driven stuff, you have to withhold judgment. So to answer your question... So I stopped writing once I surrendered to the notion of letting him into the narrative as much as the other characters, who were all Americans. I stopped writing for 4 months, and I read all day. And I started by reading an overview of Islam. Then I read the Quran cover to cover. Then I read the history of Saudi Arabia. Then I read about 9/11. And then I studied more Saudi customs. And then I interviewed a Palestinian who lived in Saudi Arabia. I interviewed an Arab scholar, on and on and on. And the day I sat down, and by the way, I was afraid the novel was dying on me while I was away from it. Because, you know, I say this a lot to writing students, and it's a little, it's a strange analogy maybe, but I do think that whether you're a male or female writer, that when you're writing your story, you're pregnant with that story. And in the same way that a baby, a fetus, multiplies, the cells divide and multiply in a woman's dark womb, the same is happening with you as the writer. The story is growing inside you in a mysterious, dark place. And you got to keep getting daily blood nutrients to the baby. So I was away from the baby for 4 months, so I was really afraid it could be dying on me. And so I remember it was a Tuesday afternoon. It was cold weather, and I was in my, you know, I wrote this novel in my, you know, bathroom, honestly, future bathroom, next to the hole in the floor that's going to be a toilet someday. And that explains the whole book, you know, the whole...
It's a glamorous life.
There you go. Writer, yeah, glamorous life. But the very first day I began to write again was the day I was going to try to go from his point of view, Bassam al-Jazani's point of view. And the very first word, I could feel him right at my shoulder. I could feel him right there. I could feel him. And I'll tell you, man, I mean, there's a great line from D.H. Lawrence. I don't write, but it's not I who writes, but the wind that blows through me. And of course, that to young writers sounds very romantic. You just show up and gush. Well, you know, it's more than that.
Right.
You know, there is revision.
The wind often doesn't blow.
Yeah, I know. And usually there's nothing happening. But he came, and he kept coming. And I'll just end answering this part of the question, David, on this, is that I do believe that if writing, at least character-driven fiction, if this kind of act is nothing else, it's sort of a sustained act of empathy, where you're constantly asking, what's it like to be you? So now what? And now what? And in a very short period of time, I forgot about my judgmental fears, and I look forward to seeing what the hell he was going to do and think and feel next, and what he was going to show me next.
Would you be willing to read a passage about him, just to introduce mm-hmm. him to the crowd?
All right. I'm going to read a 400-page passage. I let him go and go, apparently. Now, I'll read a brief... I think this is the second time the reader sees him, and it's just a brief scene where he's come back to the west coast of Florida to take money out of a bank to wire back to Dubai, and he saw her months before at this club, and he's come back to see her again, this one of these dancers, who's the other main character. So he's in the strip club right now. He sees her. She leads men, one at a time, to the soft chairs. Her face is raised, and each kafir pays for one song or two. Bassam sees only her back as she dances, her long hair, her hips. He looks away. He drinks his vodka, so new to him, but already so old. He is ready to leave it behind, but not yet. Not yet. Many whores come to him, their eyes and teeth and warm skin he can smell, but he waves them away. He will wait. He will watch those on the stage, and he will wait for her to come to him, and if she does not, he will accept this as what is deemed to happen, inshallah. The bills push tightly against both his legs. It makes him feel he has enough fuel for a long trip, when in fact this trip is nearly over. This is not something he thinks, but feels, an end approaching and a beginning, everyone here in a shadow world. This dancing woman upon the stage wears nothing but the hat of cowboys. He sits far enough away, she does not attempt to seduce any bills from him, just the kuffar seated near her. Her kous is shaved, and she spreads her knees apart, and Bassam can see it, her folds opening slightly. And he should look away, for a yearning rises in him that leaves him only alone. He no longer sees the sin that will condemn her. He sees only the flowering herbs and dusty streets of Khamis Mashat. feels again the nothing he was as Bassam, son of Ahmed al-Jazani, brother to Khalid and 14 more, brother to two sisters whose eyes smiled at him from behind their abayas, good girls, good Muslims, not like he was, not like Khalid was, though they lived across from the mosque built by their father and his many workers from Yemen and Sudan, each day the five calls to prayer from the loudspeakers. So many times during the day, working as a stock boy like any Arab, not a Saudi, not an Al-Jazani, working in the housewares shop behind Al Jazeera paints, he had to handle and store cheaply made incense burners, rolled carpets, lamps, crates of dishware and tea glasses, even having to clean away the reddish dust from the street that settled upon everything, having to bear the commands of Ali al-Fahd, who smelled of body odor and the hunger for nothing but more and more rials, his thobe stretching across his belly, his breath, old cardamom and coffee. Then Bassam would use the dur and ars prayers to pray to the Creator, but to escape the shop and Ali al-Fahd, who stayed in his office to pray. Other workers, too, the salesmen who treated Bassam as if he were not the son of Ahmed al-Jazani, they would pray to the wall facing Mecca, but Bassam would walk to the open-air souk closed for prayer, and he would sit under a tent and smoke an American cigarette. If his father asked why he was not in the mosque he built, he would lie to him, tell him he prayed in the shop with the other men. But sometimes Ali al-Fahd would lock his office and walk with others to the mosque, and Bassam would have to go, but he did not take the proper time for his ablutions. And when he stood barefoot inside with the men, facing the imam's back and Mecca, he would perform the rakats. I'll wait. Go ahead. It's all right. I just saw you. My dear cousin's here too, my beautiful cousin. Hello, Maggie. But sometimes Ali al-Fahd would lock his office and walk with others to the mosque, and Bassam would have to go, but he did not take the proper time for his ablutions. And when he stood barefoot inside with the men, facing the imam's back and Mecca, he would perform the rakats, but his mind was not with the sustainer and provider. It wandered to idle time with his brother and friends. It wandered to all they did in their nothingness he did not yet know was nothing. After Bassam's work, they would drive Khalid's Grand Am to Highway 15. His older brother, with his university degree, had no work and spent his days at the cafe in Abha, playing billiards in Ballo, smoking apple tobacco in the water pipe or his Marlboros, paying to sit at a computer screen made by the Kufar. His face, always handsome, had taken a yellowish color, and through the black market, he had acquired a cassette player for the Grand Am, and he installed it beneath the driver's seat, and he only played the forbidden music when he and Bassam were racing on the road of death, passing Imad and Karim in their Le Mans, passing Tariq in his blue duster with the 440 engine they left far behind on the hot highway, Khalid leaning into the wheel, Kufar music filling the inside. No one could hear. Such a strange sound it was, such happy, angry noise. And the singer, David Lee Roth, an American Jew, he wore a cowboy hat like this whore, and he filled their heads with a nothingness that only made Khalid drive faster, faster, always winning, always victorious. "Another drink, honey?" The kafir serving woman leans close, her hair brushing his arm, and he pulls away. "Yes." He points to the bills on the table, and she nods and takes $20 for the drink he has not yet received, but he does not care. Tomorrow, inshallah, he and Imad and Tariq travel north. Amir and the others there now, and there is the feeling he has already left, like being home again in the national park in Azir, viewing the valley from atop Mount Suda, above everything, beyond everything. Nothing below can touch him, except that which has weakened him. A new whore dances now. Her legs and arms are pale and thin, but her nuhud sways heavily and puts him in mind of an animal, and he looks once more behind him for the other. She dances for a kafir seated before her. The man wears eyeglasses, and he smiles approvingly, and Bassam looks back at this new one. She has taken off everything very fast, and she seems young and stupid about these things. He looks once more to the women dancing alone for the seated kufar, and there she is still, Bassam, and it's difficult not to stare at her bare back, her hair swaying against it. Under the low light, there are more dancers now, and in the dark corner, a fat kafir guards a private room, its entry covered with black draping. Here you go, hon. The hand of the server, his drink leaving her tray, the bills she leaves there, hoping he will instruct her to keep them. Please, Bassam points to the guarded room in the fat kafir. That area, what is this? She follows his arm, his finger. Champagne room, big money for that, hon. 300 to the club, 2 to the dancer, 1 hour. Thank you. He waves her away. He waves her away and feels like a king. The power of a man in this world who cares about this world, the things of it, its things. At the Venice airfield, they allowed for the first time Amir to fly alone. Bassam sat beside him as they flew over the water, the same greenish-brown and dark blue of the Red Sea. For moments and moments, they were silent. The land and cities of the far enemy were below to the east, and Amir pulled up the nose of the plane, the weight of the earth pulling Bassam's head back against the seat. Above them, only the deep blue of where they would rise, and he felt afraid. Allahu Akbar, Amir said softly. The Egyptian was smiling then, his eyes upon the invisible doors to Jana. Bassam, never the pilot or driver, always the passenger. Khalid alone, when the speeding Grand Am hit the sand blown onto the highway, and perhaps Khalid jerked the steering wheel, the auto or forbidden music turning over once, twice, three times, his body thrown so many meters to the west, away from Mecca, the American Jew still singing inside the crushed chassis. A man stands closely to the stage holding a bill for the young whore lying on her back. The music is too loud. In Khamis Mushat, there was only talk on the street, the hawking of wares in the souks, passing autos and minibuses, the calls to prayer. But here in the land of the Al-Adu al-Bayid, there is nothing but noise. Music from auto radios and stereos, televisions and cafes, in shop windows, in airport and bus terminals and malls, from the open windows of every single home, talk, 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 the horns of impatient mushrikun, the loud engines of motorcycles, the spinning blades of helicopters above to report the squeezing traffic, small planes over the beach trailing banners to make the kufar spend their dirty money on more needless things, and the flesh of women exposed on all of them. Even the old wear dresses above their knees, the young in short, short pants that can only tempt men. They are nearly naked on the covers of every magazine, on books, on television, even when only selling beer or watches or pickup trucks, and alcohol, wherever you want it, in bars and restaurants in every street corner, in stores for selling food. Even in small fuel stations, you can buy them as well as your cigarettes and magazines, the tiny bottles you can drink while driving home to your television. And these churches and synagogues, these stone and brick buildings of false idols for these polytheists to worship, Bassam would rig them with plastique and explode them to hell. A woman's hands on his shoulders, her breath hot in his ear. Want a private, sweetie? Just you and me? No. Honey, come on, one dance, you and me. She smells a perfume, and now she shows him her face. She is from China or Japan or Cambodia, her hands on his chest, her eyes shining with hunger for his money. Enough. He stands and leaves her the bills on the table, and he goes in search of the one he came here for, the one with the eyes that seem to see Bassam, son of Azir, son of the Gamdi clan of the Khotan tribe, chosen by Abu Abdullah himself, Bassam. Mansour Bassam Al-Jazani. Thank you.
Thanks. So I want to come back to this. We were talking about a little bit before about withholding judgment, because you withhold judgment from all the characters. I mean, all of the main characters here, Bassam, April, who's the stripper, AJ, who gets involved in other ways, are characters that are complicated and make bad choices, shall we say.
Yeah.
And so I'm curious about that too, in terms of the complexity of you know, from a novelist's point of view or from an observer in the world's point of view. Obviously, the drama is more interesting if characters make bad choices and then they have to figure out ways out of them. But what's interesting to me about these three characters and the other characters in the book too is that it's almost things become inevitable really quickly. They make one sort of small bad choice, and then there's another small bad choice, and then very quickly they've crossed the point of no return. And they're in a situation that begins to develop before they were even aware that anything was developing. So I wanted to ask you about that as a kind of, you know, from your point of view as a writer.
Well, I can tell you that I'm never conscious of this stuff, and maybe it's good that I'm not. And I think I'm inflicting so much of my own demons on my readers, it's abusive. I remember I read a description of my first book, a collection of short stories, it was a review, and said something like, these characters are given to drinking and violence and sexual desire. And I thought, well, that was me in my 20s. You know, and then I have to have a little story to tell you. So this would be before House of Sand and Fog came out. My wife's a dancer, and she upholsters furniture, and I'm a writer who does carpentry jobs, and we were always broke, and we were having our kids, and we're having a bad morning, you know, stressful morning. Some bills were late. A bathroom remodeling job fell through. My coffee was lousy. We were arguing. We didn't even give each other a kiss. I get in. The thing hardly starts up. I'm thinking, I can't afford another damn repair. I'm late for work. It was a teaching day and not a carpentry day. I pull out on the main road, and a guy almost runs me over with his truck. And I was so mad. If that little shitbox I own could go fast, I would have gone up and run him off the road and pulled him out of his car and beaten him unconscious with road rage. 2 days later, I got this bathroom remodeling job. I got $1,000 up front, paid the bills, bought some groceries. My wife and I had a lovely morning. Kids were great. Coffee was wonderful. Car started up. Another guy cuts me off at the corner, same way. And I just remember thinking, be careful, brother. Go in peace. You might hurt someone or someone else. And it got me thinking about this whole nature of this sort of psychic cushion we all have. And when things are... I mean, I think the saints among us are big and magnanimous and loving when life is hard for them, too. But we mere mortals, you know, when, you know, up against the wall, we all become killers. This is one of the things that... Right? You know, I mean, it could just be... The car didn't start, my coffee was bad, so I kept punching him, officer. What can I tell you? And so I truly believe that, you know, these I used to work in the prison system, and I remember, and I think this is probably a very revealing or shaping experience for me as a writer. I was 22 years old, and I worked in a halfway house in Colorado, and these people had come from Canyon City Maximum Security Penitentiary. And they were just killers, rapists, thieves, but, you know, people who had done sexual assault and killed people. And one guy was one of the warmest guys. Well, he wasn't warm, but he was gentle. He was meek. He tried to resolve conflicts between other inmates. He read, you know, really good novels, maybe five a week, and we talked about literature. One day late, I look up his file, and I see that he killed his daughter's two boys with a baseball bat. Lost it, and, you know, he did 28 years in the pen. He's a child murderer. I mean, there's not a worse thing on earth, in my opinion. And I'm talking to this guy, but I had to admit to the fact, you guys, I had to admit that I liked him. Right. But boy, did I hate what he did. And it was kind of hard to talk literature for a month or two with him. But the long and the short of it, what I'm saying, Dave, is that I think one of the things I seem to be working out in my stories, and certainly in the Garden of Last Days, I think, is this whole notion that, you know, it's bumper sticker Christianity, but, you know, hate the sin and not the sinner.
Right. Right. Well, it's also interesting because AJ, who's sort of one of the antagonists in the story, and, you know, has a restraining order against him from his wife, and he's been evicted from the club for touching one of the dancers. This is all early in the book, so I'm trying to give away details that aren't, you know, key here. But you do, I mean, this is a guy who's overwhelmed. And when you're in his head, you know, on the one hand, maybe it's rationalization, maybe it's not, but he's got these bills to pay. He's got alimony. All he ever did was try to build, you know, make a home. He did this, he did that. He wasn't like his dad and didn't leave. He, you know, all these kind of things. And, you know, yeah, he's done some bad things, or he does some bad things, but he's not a bad guy. Or maybe he's a bad guy. It's more complicated than that.
Well, it's interesting you put it that way, because I guess
I mean, I kind of like the guy. Maybe that says something about me.
I kind of liked him, too. And also, he did the other thing that I have no tolerance
right,
for, which
exactly.
is hitting a woman.
Yeah, exactly.
However, here he is, one of these guys. So, but it's interesting. You know, we live in a – let me just get on the soap. I'll be political for a second.
You go for
it. And I never think about this stuff when I'm writing. And if I start to think about this stuff when I'm writing fiction, then I start to get nervous. But I do think that we live in a fundamentalist time. And I don't just mean that in a religious sense. I think the reason John Kerry didn't have a chance is he's too intellectual, that he'll have 25 responses to one issue. By fundamentalist, I mean almost in a musical sense, where there are no undertones and no overtones. And I don't know why we're so rigid right now as a culture, but I think George Bush is the president we deserve in that respect. I do. I think we had a fundamentalist man rose from this fundamentalist gestalt. So what I'm saying is, you just talk about good guy, bad guy, good man. I was at a party two nights ago, and really great crowd of people, and the science writer, one of these incredible guys who can write about things like particle physics and still talk sports, was there. And he was talking about a guy, and he said, you know, he's not a good man. And I remember thinking, I just can never say that. I just can never say that. I guess I don't believe in the notion of good men and good women and bad men and bad women. I just don't think we can be nouns. I think we are verbs, you know. So there was another lady in this halfway house. She was an old lady who was the sweetest thing I'd met in years. She was so warm to me. I was so lonely and homesick in Colorado. She was trying to fix me up with her daughter, which violated all the rules of the halfway house. She taught me how to bake a turkey for Thanksgiving, and I look up her story, and she shot her husband 5 times in the face. Old June, and I still like old June.
It was a bad night, right?
It was a bad night. It was a bad night for him, I'll tell you. So, I mean, does that make sense? And I try not to think about this, but I'm constantly surprised when people talk about the unsavory. There's a review the other day. Unsavory characters in my stories. I thought, unsavory? I don't know, just guys like me.
Well,
probably unsavory.
But that's what I'm saying. All of them are. You know, it seems to me that everyone in the book is just someone trying to figure out how to get through. Even Bassam, who, you know, whatever. I'm not, again, not to. It's tricky with that kind of character entirely.
It's tricky.
But this is a guy. I mean, in terms of his theology and his sense of what the afterlife is, it's a physical death. I mean, it's a physical destination. That's really interesting to me, the idea that, you know, we'll be in 24 hours, we'll be there. It's like, you know, the plane's going to land, and that's where it's going to land. And that was eye-opening, because all of a sudden you do start, it humanizes in the most fundamental sense, not in the fundamentalist sense, but the most fundamental sense, because you're looking at someone who has really found a warped way to get through, but is looking for a structure and a meaning and a way to make sense of it.
Yeah, and I think you described that perfectly. And without giving away too much in the book, you know, it's interesting. So he, out of all the characters in the story, he's the one with the strongest belief system. I began to think, you know, these people don't have enough beliefs, and he's got too much.
Mm-hmm.
You know, April could use a little religion.
Right. I mean,
he needs a lot less.
Right. But he's got I mean, that's the thing that's kind of scary, is at a certain point you're like, well, this guy's got, I hesitate to say he's got a point. But when he's talking about sort of the meaninglessness and the amorality of the world that he's observing, you know, he's observing meaninglessness and amorality. It's what his response to that observation is that defines him in some ways as a character. But the observation itself is not necessarily unsound. It's kind of interesting. And then that throws, from a reader's point of view, that throws everything up in the air, and you got to kind of deal with the complexity of the individual and the individual situation, just like you're saying.
And also in light of what this guy went on to do to,
exactly.
real, to real people.
Exactly.
Who a reader may have loved.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, and then it becomes really complicated. So I want to ask you a little bit just about the structure of the book, because the bulk of the book takes place in one night. Mm-hmm. And I wanted... Yeah, mostly.
Hey, you're right.
Most of it. About there you go.
I'm not kidding. Critics, I'm telling you, what I love about smart people reading your book, you learn so much about what the hell you just wrote. No, you really do. Well, you're right about that. Oh, no.
Right. So, I mean, well, then, so you probably can't answer the question. I'm curious about
no,
that.
No, I can't. But I bet you can. I mean that with all due respect.
No, I'm interested in that, though, as a way, like, in terms of writing, it's an epic about a very small series of, the actual incidents in the book and the events are fairly small, but it's this book that kind of goes into kind of epic length and depth in some ways on these things. The whole world is contained in this night in some way. Yeah. And I'm curious about kind of what that was like to, as a writer, to plunge that deeply into a really concise period of time.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you brought that up. I did have real conscious fears. So, you know, I began with this thought that I'm just going to write this short story from the point of view of a stripper. I had a fellowship, and I had money in the bank that's supposed to be used for research. And I thought, well, I've never done what you're supposed to do with those things. I'm going to actually spend it on research. And so I actually went to my wife, Fontaine, and said, you know, honey, I can never talk about what I'm working on when I'm working on it. It's that whole baby thing. I didn't want to keep it protected. So I said, I'm working on something, and I really need to go on a research trip. Oh, okay, how long? Just a weekend. And I think I need to take Bill, who's a big power lifter, old high school buddy, and my brother. Okay, where are you going? Well, some strip clubs in Florida. She looked at me and she said, huh? This is his niece, his sister's daughter. I said, yeah. Honestly, I don't know. I felt like I was lying. I said, well, I don't know anything about that world. I just have to go there. And believe me, that's all I'm doing. She looked at me. She said, you know, you could really screw me over. And I said, can I go? Yeah, so I went. My point is, I found so much fascinating stuff with that whole business in just the 3 days of interviewing dancers and soaking up the atmosphere that when I began writing what I thought would be a short story focused on this woman, it just kept going on and on, and there were so many parts of it. And then I felt this thrilling thing that writers feel if we're lucky, which is this sense that there are all sorts of metaphorical depths happening all at once. You know, as you probably know, the word metaphor, I think, comes from Latin, might be Greek, but it means to carry further. And everywhere I went, whether it's the point of view of the bouncer Lonnie Pike or April or any others in this story, I began to feel that I may never leave this club. That the whole there was so much to find. But then I was worried because lots of times writers have that feeling, and you end up overwriting, and you've got hundreds of pages that Elmore Leonard had a great line. He said, "Try to leave out the parts that the reader skips." So I wasn't sure. But so the structure part, I was really glad. Excuse me, early on in the novel, I go into the character of AJ, this guy who's kicked out of the club, and I was really glad just to get the hell out of there and get in his truck with him.
Right.
And I was really glad he drove away.
Right.
And said, good, let's get the hell out of that club.
Right.
Of course, what he does is...
Yeah, but it's interesting because then you hit that density, and it's and the fact that it takes place at night, you got the sense that, the night, because it's dark, because it's less defined, lots of things can happen. It's not like the day. People who are out are not necessarily out for a purpose. You know?
Well, that's another thing I discovered. I really wasn't a strip club guy. I went to one drunk when I was 20 at a bachelor party, and I hadn't been back at one. And I was struck by how, at the very first glimmer, they reminded me of casinos where there are no windows, mm-hmm. and there's no way out. Once you're in, it's like Hotel California. You can never leave. And I ordered a whiskey, and I, you know, they're all over you, and I'm looking at naked women drinking a whiskey, and you know, you got to go through five doors to get out, and it's a man's dream world. It's actually 11-year-old boy's dream world, I think, really. But you're there, and I can see where it becomes an incredible, possibly addictive drug of escaping your world, and of course you're going to drop hundreds of dollars before you're out of there.
Right, $100 that you're not even aware you're dropping,
you're
right, until
aware.
You actually walk out, and then you're aware you've dropped them, you know.
He said knowingly.
Right. I read your book.
Yeah, okay. It was good.
Okay, before we get ourselves in any more trouble, let's turn it over to you guys. So if you raise your hand, we can bring the microphone to you. There's right in the back over there.
Lady in the purple.
Wow. What authors, if any, do you appreciate and admire now? And particularly, which authors did you admire as you were growing up?
Thank you. A great question about writers. Well, you know, I dedicated this book to one of my favorite American writers, Larry Brown, who was a friend of mine late in his life. I knew him maybe 4 years before he died. You guys, if you haven't read Larry Brown, you need to go read the novels or short stories of Larry Brown. One of my favorites is his novel, Father and Son. Joe is another, I think, masterful novel. And the reason I love his work so much, well, it's the kind of stuff I try to write too, which is I'm a sucker for compassionate, character-driven stories where you can really feel the writer just trying to understand these people and trying to illuminate some kind of truth with our humble little tools, whatever they are. I really don't care for a lot of young, hip stuff that's out there. I don't like big, fat books with bibliographies. I don't like tricks. I don't like 30-word sentences when 9 will do. I don't like calling attention to the writer. I don't like authorial intrusion. I'm a pretty rigid reader, actually. So I like a lot of people like that. I adore and absolutely light a candle to the great Alice Munro, the Canadian short story writer, who I'm sure you know. It's just, the planet should be named after her. My father, André Debus, is one of my favorite writers. Go read his short stories. But, you know, honestly, I think I probably read more poetry than fiction. And I read poetry every day, almost like a prayer. I bring it with me when I travel. I'm reading, one of my favorite American poets is Stephen Dunn. He won the Pulitzer Prize for his poetry, Different Hours. Do you know his stuff? Dunn, D-U-N-N. I'm reading his collection now, The Insistence of Beauty. I love Carolyn Forché, Marie Howe, Sharon Olds. But to finish answering your question, the first novel when I was a kid that really kind of took my head off and made me believe that literature, made me feel that literature was something to be taken seriously and that could actually enrich my life for the rest of my life was The Grapes of Wrath. That final scene with the Rose of Sharon, I remember I put it down. You know, we all know the Grapes, they're all those sociological chapters he should have cut, but it's still a great novel, right? And that final scene with Rose of Sharon, I remember when I put the book down, I was trembling. I was 17. I went downstairs, it was a Saturday morning, and my mother was home, and you know, I came to the kitchen, I said, I'm not even going to college. Well, why should I study economics and sociology and politics and psychology? I'll just read novels. I'll just read Steinbeck. I don't know if I'm going to college, Ma. I did, but. And I studied sociology, economics, and politics. Exactly.
Hi, I loved, one of the things I loved about The House of Sand and Fog was the perfect balance between the two main characters, that they were both so right and so wrong at the same time, not so much with the film. And I'm curious if that was something you were striving for. It sounds like it wasn't the way that you write about writing so unconsciously, or if that's just a baby you gave birth to. But was that something that you strived for? Was that kind of moral balance between them or if it's something that you had to adjust as you were writing, or if it just came
out that way. It's actually just something I found. I thank you for that question. By the way, if I look a little beleaguered when I turn my head, I think I have a middle ear infection. And these little crystals, like looking at you during this interview, I get a little dizzy. So if I have to just stop and look ahead, it's so I don't fall over. And I haven't been drinking, I know I'm on tour and all. So I would write from the colonel's point of view. And I would think, who is this slob? Who is this woman who can't take care of her affairs, who could, if she went to the proper authorities, could sue for enough money to buy 10 homes? I'm the rightful owner. I've done nothing wrong. This is my opportunity. This is not my problem. She needs to go somewhere else. I felt it completely. When I'm her, I'm thinking, who's this rigid, tyrannical son of a bitch? Right? And then when I was Lester, I was drunk and horny with a gun. But again, it goes back, there's a great line, and I know there are other writers in the room. If you haven't read The Nature and Aim of Fiction by Flannery O'Connor, that's the only essay I think anyone needs to read about writing, and her essay, Writing Short Stories. But one of the things she says is that the job of the writer is not to write about character, but with character. So again, it's this whole notion of, it's like acting, but great acting, where acting isn't pretending, but being. These great actors, as you know, feel these feelings and they take them on, and that's why it can be so emotionally draining to play a role, is they have these emotions. They're not pretending to have them or indicating them. And so, to answer your question, I was completely on her side, completely on his, and I was gratified as the writer to feel a balance, But I honestly never took any sides, except when I look back as a father and husband, I think I'm a little with him, but then I'm not.
No way back.
When you read the passage that you just read, it struck me, you know, the description of the United States from the view of someone, you know, a newcomer and someone from another culture, basically. And I'm just wondering what your experience is when, as you write a character like that, does that bring up ideas or thoughts about America that you perhaps hadn't had before?
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. I was thinking about this whole notion of revision. You know, I tell my students, you know, revision is everything. It's everything. Paul Engle said that writing is rewriting what you've already rewritten. And right, and revision actually means when you break it down to see again. And the reason I'm bringing up revision is I try to tell my students, well, you know when you go away for a week or two or longer and then you come back to your house or your apartment and it just doesn't look the same? You know, the porch looks a little crooked, the doorknob is loose, and what's that smell in this house? And has that wall always been that dirty? And how long has the TV been broken? You know, and you're coming back and you're seeing it again with new eyes because you stepped away from your perspective. And so that's what happens when I found it when I wrote from the point of view of the Iranian man, and then I found it from the point of view of this young Saudi, completely different people, but I began to see it from a whole different angle, which was kind of stimulating. Disturbing, but interesting. For that reason, the stepping out, which is frankly, I think, why I write in the first place. I love getting the hell out of me, if that makes sense.
Hi, I've got like a 75-part question under one heading, so bear with me. All under the category of film adaptation, what was your involvement, experience, observation of seeing The House in Sand and Fog made into a film? And is this one you've been approached on? Do you think it could be made into a film? What would you see being different, like in terms of external manifestation versus what you can get into, obviously, in a character's head?
Are you a filmmaker?
A screenwriter?
We should talk.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. I had very little to do. I had more to do with the adaptation of House of Sand and Fog than fiction writers get, because the writer-director, Vadim Perlman, was a first-time director and didn't know that fiction writers are the lowest form of the earth and are supposed to just get a check and told to take off and get lost. Yeah, second. I know screenwriters are the lowest. And he was a really great guy. I mean, the House of Sand and Fog got so much. My film agent got 140 something calls in 18 months, and I would talk to people now and then. He would forward to me people he thought would be good to make the film, and the conversation always ended the same. So they would say nice things dramatically, and they'd say, but we have to soften the ending. And it was almost always the same verb, soften. I said, what do you mean, soften? So, well, you know, it's a downer, man. They said, yeah, it's a freaking tragedy. They're downers. So what, Romeo and Juliet, they don't die in the end. They get married, get fat and happy, have a pizza parlor in Verona. Freaking Hollywood. And I'd politely hang up. Well, then Vadim Perlman called, and he's this Ukrainian man with a slight accent. We talked for an hour, and I liked him, and he was kind of intimidatingly smart. And then he said very passionately, forgive the language, the image is really disturbing, but I have to share it with you. I have to inflict it upon you. He said, you may get a lot of money from some big movie so-and-so, so-and-so, but they are going to take your baby. They're going to chain it to the radiator, and they're going to rape and kill it. I said, oh, Jesus. Are all Ukrainians like you? I said, what are you going to do, Mr. Perlman? I'm not going to hurt your baby. You wrote a dark book. I'm going to make a dark movie. It will only be seen in art houses, and nobody will go see it. I said, you're my man. And so he sent me all the scripts, and I got to read them, and which is funny because even if I had a a note, he'd say, okay, thanks. But nothing happened. But I like the movie. I think it's very, very loyal to the book. I think it should be 4 hours longer and bring in more of my book, but that's a movie. And about the Garden of the Last Days, it's already, much to my shock, things are happening with all sorts of people, much to my shock. Because I didn't think anyone would want to go near this for reasons we've discussed earlier. And but if they want to, they can. You go right ahead. But I really want nothing to do with it. I realized on the with the House of Sand and Fog, I went on the tour with the director, and I just realized at the end of it, you know, I don't love movies. I just kind of like them. I like movies, but I don't love them. I realize why I don't love movies. And, you know, of course we know there's some great ones out there that can change your life like any other art form. I realize I don't love them because there just aren't enough sentences in them. I like sentences.
I feel exactly the
don't
same
you?
Way.
Hey,
absolutely.
Thank you.
Yeah. Absolutely. You know, it was Hemingway or Mailer said that the novelist is supposed to, the way to deal with Hollywood is you drive to the border of California, you throw your book over, you wait for them to throw the check back, and then you drive away.
Amen, brother. Amen. And a good damn problem to have. That's right.
Any other questions right in the front?
This is my cousin. You look so gorgeous tonight, honey.
Stand up,
show everybody yourself.
Oh, man.
This is my cousin, Maggie Michelle.
Hello.
This is, look at her. This is my father's sister's daughter. My father has had two sisters. Well, he's got the two sisters. He's gone. You know there are 19 kids between those three kids?
Yes, I do know that.
These French Catholics, for God's sakes. French-Irish Catholics at that.
That's right. You gave a good lead on. There are quite a few writers you're sort of joined at the hip to in that regard, and they've made vastly different choices about the use of autobiographical material in their work. And you're sort of at one whole end of the spectrum and some of the others at one other end. I really respect the way you handle it. I like that you work from imagination. Did you ever make a conscious choice about that, or did it come from some sort of sense of that? Or
that's so funny you're saying that, cuz, because Dave and I were talking about that right before we came out. For 25 years, I've been trying to write this autobiographically based novel like every other damn writer in the world. You know, we all have it's a cliche to say this now, but everybody's story is worth a book. You know, there are people in this room whose life is worth probably 10 volumes. No one's life is boring. Everyone's life is fascinating. And there's something about my little life I've been trying to get off my chest fictionally for 25 years. And after House of Sand and Fog, I went back to work on this novel that has failed a couple of times. And I spent 3 years on it, gave it to Norton. My editor wisely said, it's not there yet, go back to work. But for me, trying to create fiction from my life is like taking a knife and putting it over a fire till it's this blackened, charred, glowing instrument, and then sticking it in my eyeballs. Who the hell wants to do that? Who wants to go back there? But I still try to do it, and I can't. I think I just discovered a few months ago that I'm not a writer like Truman Capote and many other wonderful writers who can write. I can't have an experience with, you know, Uncle Harry and then write about it and just call him Uncle Joe. I've got to be the squirrel in the tree, ignoring them and writing about the fat lady over here whose son is in Iraq. And so I'm writing a memoir.
I'd love
I'm writing
to read
it straight.
You began a train of thought about after you finished 4 months of research, coming back to writing. And beginning with Bassam's story, and you started to say the first word that he said, and I don't think you finished what that word was.
I don't remember what that word was. You'd think I would know that. I don't remember what the first word was, but I know that by the time I was done with that first sentence that began with that first word, I could just feel him right there as if he'd been waiting for me to show the hell up. It was really strange. And well, maybe I should close on this whole notion of mystery, you know, of mystery. I truly believe that, I know, and I think you know too, that we're all born with an imagination. I think that some very well-meaning elementary school teachers do a number on a lot of us and convince us that, you know, we have none. Your sister's the one who can write poetry. You should be a doctor or a plumber. You know, and all a kid has to be told, all you have to do is be told that once. In the next 90 years, you don't try a poem or a painting or anything because Mrs. Thompson said it to you when you were seven. And I love what Tolstoy said. He said, you know, art is transferring feeling from one heart to another. And one thing I love about writing, and one thing I love about, you know, meeting people and talking about something I've written, which is such a privilege and an honor, and I thank you for coming, by the way, is the transmission of the story from the writer to the reader literally cannot happen unless the reader's imaginations aren't sometimes even larger and wilder and even more terrifying than the writer's. The transmission doesn't happen. It's all mysterious about why we can write one kind of thing and not another. I think the writer is the last to choose. He's the last to know, because smart people like David actually really do illuminate these things that you've written. And I'll just close with Grace Paley. I love what Grace Paley said. God bless her. She just died on us. She said, you know, we write what we don't know we know. Yeah. Thank you very much, everybody. Thank you.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arendt Fox. Additional support is provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, City National Bank, KPMG, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by David Ornette Cherry.